we have our Lucinardi, who will tell us about the things he's been working on for a while now. The approach enables scuba ballistics to general relativity. And yes, I will just leave the
thanks. Okay. So this is still work in progress, but I feel increasingly I know how to finish this story, but the paper I'm writing isn't complete yet. I ask you to be at least as struck by the words probabilistic and operational as by the word agency. I think the word agency is less often used in physics, and so it's more striking, but actually I have quite a conservative attitude towards the notion of agency, or at least a conservative attitude will do. One could take a more radical attitude if one wanted. Okay, so let's get going. So the problem of quantum gravity I would state it like this. Of course, I shouldn't be telling you guys what the problem of quantum gravity is, but I'm going to anyway. The problem of quantum gravity is to find some theory which reduces inappropriate limits to quantum theory on the one hand and general relativity on the other hand. Now, of course, this new theory, whatever it is, could be as different from either quantum theory or general relativity as general relativity itself is, for example, from Newtonian physics. It could be a very different mathematical framework. And it may be that quantum gravity is not an example of a quantum theory. It may be a quite different kind of theory. And also, we'd want, ultimately, of course, for this theory to be verified in some experiments, potentially where neither quantum theory or general relativity apply currently. One of the problems of this diagram I've drawn is that it's difficult to take a limit backwards. So let's think about that. This is the plan of attack. Well, first of all, I'm going to identify the formulations of quantum theory and general relativity that should appear as limit theories in this, and then work out how to reverse the arrows. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that the limit theories, or the particular formulations that we have, are operational quantum theory and probabilistic general relativity with agency. The reason for that is, operationalism is a very good thing. It's a very good strategy. It's a very good methodology if you're not clear on what the fundamental physics is. Operationalism is a very good way to think about the world. And you can build mathematical frameworks from that starting point. There is this operational formulation of quantum theory. So it seems like a good thing to look at in the context of this problem. And then likewise, I want an operational formulation of general relativity, but one which has the addition of probability and this notion of agency, which is essential to operational quantum theory. In this context, probability could just be understood as ignorance probabilities. So I'm not suggesting that we modify general relativity so that it becomes a stochastic theory, but rather just that we may have ignorance about the values of measured quantities. One way to think about that is that it's a fundamental human right to be ignorant and to attach probabilities to that ignorance. So that's good. Then we have to work out how to do that. I hope you noticed the difference. How to reverse the arrows. Since I'm reversing the arrows, I might as well give a new name to the theory of quantum gravity. I'm going to call it QAGER. This is quantum general relativity with agency.
So they have PAGER and QAGER, but what's the first one? How do you pronounce the first one?
Oh, sorry, yeah, that one I don't have a pronunciation for. I was thinking of renaming that as well, but the operational quantum theory is always already kind of an established name. So. So that's good, but now how do we actually follow those arrows? And so to do that, I propose introducing a fourth vertex, this thing called classical probability theory. So there's a fairly well-established theory of classical processes where you can think of this in terms of circuits, where you have boxes and they have associated with them stochastic maps. So these are maps that do the appropriate mixing. The state spaces are described by simplexes and so on. It's a very well understood framework. And so the idea is to look at the process by which you go from, does this work? Yep, there we go. Well, the process by which you go from classical probabilities of operational quantum theory is a kind of quantization. And what seems to be happening is you're replacing these classical simplexes, these classical simplexes of probability theory, of classical probability theory, by curved convex sets which derive from a Hilbert space. So that's how you go up here. It's a kind of quantization. But then we also, if we compare these two theories, then we may have something which we could call grisation. I think Penrose referred to this as gravitization, and is that right? And Laurent had to talk about this. So the idea is finding something that relates, well, in this case, the classical probability theory with probabilistic general relativity with agency. And the thing that's going to differ when you go from here to here is that in this case, you'll have some kind of fixed causal structure, fixed background, whereas over here, well, your background will become dynamical, and then you add probabilities. That means that your causal structure will be fuzzy. So that presents a particular challenge in this vertex. And the hope is that if you manage to formulate this, then you would have solved some of the problems of finding a theory of quasar, quantum gravity, and that by applying some sort of quantization process such as this one, replacing the classical probability simplexes here with convex sets that derive from a Hilbert space, one can go up to here. That's the sort of strategy I imagine. Okay, so this is part of an ongoing project. I've been thinking about this for a while, and several years ago, 10 years ago, I developed this thing called the causaloid framework, which is a framework for probabilistic theories of indefinite causal structure. I developed this thing called the Dewar tensor framework, which is a way to do probability theory in a sort of manifestly covariant way for circuits. So this is a kind of discrete covariance, except that you can imagine how to apply this to space-time. And then I did the quantum version of that more recently. And most recently, I've been thinking about this sort of theory of composition in physics. I'll talk about that later if I get time. It seems that composition is a very general thing that you do in physics, and it's interesting to have a general theoretical framework for composition. And there's lots of related work out there. You'll recognize maybe some of these things. It was Chris Fuchs who got me thinking in this sort of agent-centric approach to quantum theory. Not just me, many people were influenced by that. He has his own approach, which he calls cubism, but I think the broader philosophy that he initiated has been very influential in the work that I'm going to present. There's the group in Oxford who apply category theoretic methods. Really, it's a sort of pictorial approach to looking at the structure of quantum theory, and this emphasizes compositionality as well. There's a whole bunch of generalized probability theories. The people have done work on that both back in the 60s and a lot of work has been done recently. And then there's lots of different space-time approaches to quantum theory. So people in the quantum gravity community will know about some of this. And this list is very incomplete, of course. I won't go through the whole list. Okay, operational quantum theory. So in some ways, it is a big success of the last century, this formulation of quantum theory. But I would say it's sort of an unsung working class hero. Unsung because people don't normally think of it as being a sort of good candidate for fundamental physics. It's sort of taken to be some sort of effective physics where you use density matrices. And working class because it actually has been used to great effect in the context of quantum information. It has agency built in the sense that you have a notion of knob settings. It's sort of the mathematical apparatus consists of density matrices, these things called completely positive maps, which as far as I can see were invented by Sudarshan in the 60s, and positive operator valued measures. And then you calculate probabilities using this equation here. The approach is abstract and dry, and that's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing because you take enough of the physics out that you can see the real structure of quantum theory. It's kind of laid bare in these objects here. And actually, it's very simple. The constraints on these objects are all very simple constraints. And actually, you can unify them, the constraints on these objects, in the next thing I'll talk about. Most people in quantum information and quantum foundations, well, everyone in quantum information, most people in quantum foundations know this stuff. If you don't know this stuff and you think that all measurements are associated with Hermitian operators, as quantum textbooks say, well, then that's just plain wrong. Measurements have positive operator valued measures associated with them, which sometimes can correspond to Hermitian operators. Okay, so there's various modern incarnations of operational quantum physics, and I have my own version, which I call the operator tensor formulation. And it looks like this. So imagine you have a circuit. So this is a bunch of boxes wired together with systems passing between them. And each of these boxes could have some lights that might flash or not. Well, you can describe this circuit here by in this notation. So you see here there's a wire that goes from box A to B. And here's an index A1 and A1. So the one indicates that wire and so on. And you can show that you can write down quantum theory in the operator tensor formulation so that the probability of the light flashing on each of these boxes, the given light on each of these boxes flashing, is given by a calculation like this. And here, the notation, what it means is when you have a repeated index, that means that you're taking the partial trace over some appropriate part of the Hilbert space on which these operators act. One thing that's nice about this formalism is that it's sort of manifestly covariant. So you don't here have to think in terms of evolving a state in time, where you provide a state at each point in time, but rather you just directly translate the description of your circuit into a calculation. So the idea is to try and do something similar for quantum gravity, for general relativity. Ultimately, quantum gravity. PAGER. So PAGER stands for probabilistic general relativity with agency. I chose the name because it's a homage to the BlackBerry PAGER, which got the Perimeter Institute started. The A is out of sequence, but that's a selling point because we have fuzzy causal structure in this theory. Hopefully, if we construct this, then we'll be able to have to confront some of the problems of quantum gravity. You might think of this as sort of a Copenhagen interpretation of general relativity. I can't imagine Einstein being more upset by anything else than such an idea. So the approach will be operational and compositional. I'm going to introduce something like a Heisenberg cut, where you talk about that bit of the world you're interested in looking at, because after all, we're trying to be operational. In a sense, we're going to inject the measurement problem into general relativity, except that the ontology will remain clear. So we'll just inject the measurement structure into general relativity. So our strategy is to attempt accommodation of these two theories, quantum theory and general relativity, by bringing general relativity down to the level of quantum theory, rather than attempting to elevate quantum theory to the status of general relativity is this beautiful mathematical structure, and quantum theory is riddled with interpretational problems of one sort or another.
The grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah, you too. So there's this general area I mentioned earlier, so general probability theories. So there's been a lot of work done on this recently. The approach in this area is to look at mathematical objects which are linear in probabilities. If you think about the density matrix, for example, Well, that's actually linearly related to a list of probabilities. The quantum state, psi, the sort of vector of Hilbert space, on the other hand, sort of behaves like the square root of probabilities. If you work with objects which are linear in probability, you're in a much better position to consider generalizations of quantum theory, because you can look at sort of general space, the general landscape of such theories. If you stick with objects which are specific to quantum theory, like state vectors in a Hilbert space, then it's much more difficult to consider generalizations because those objects are tailor-made for doing quantum theory. They don't relate very well to this more general framework. So within this landscape, you can think of various points. So there's classical probability theory. There's all the things I mentioned on previous slide. Operational quantum theory, you can try to put Page up here, and then quantum or Quager right in the distance is this sort of promised land. There's things like the Speckens toy model. And then there's the sort of box world that John Barrett and has worked on, others. So here's a sort of landscape of theories. And it's useful to think in this sort of very general landscape because you may be in a better position to narrow down what the particular properties are of this or this. So standard general relativity. Well, a solution in general relativity is given by specifying at all points on a manifold a set of tensors. So you have these tensor fields for the metric and the various matter fields. So if you specify all these, so you specify for each point, you specify these tensors, then you specify a solution in general relativity. When I wrote this down in my paper, I was looking for a Greek letter to associate with that, and I'd used all the other Greek letters, so I was forced to use the symbol psi. But it's kind of appropriate. It sort of, in some ways, is similar to solutions in the context of quantum theory. In general relativity, everything is built out of fields, so you can consider things like test particles, clocks, and so on. But those are just approximations. These objects have to be built out of fields if they're to be properly incorporated into the theory. These solutions must satisfy a set of coupled partial differential equations. You have the matter equations, which are obtained from special relativity by the Kommeter semicolon rule and changing the Minkowski metric into the general metric. And then now you have this general thing. You have introduced 10 parameters, you need some extra equations to solve for those, and that's the Einstein field equations. Although there's a problem, although it looks like you have 10 equations, there's actually some identities, which means you only have really 6 equations. And then the solution to that is that Beobles are actually given by functions on this solution that are invariant under diffeomorphisms. I should note here, I'm using the word Beobles from quantum foundations. Usually in general relativity and quantum gravity, people call these observables. But that's the wrong word, as you'll see shortly. Beobles are the things that are taken to be real, the things that are physical. The word was invented by John Bell, and it's completely appropriate to these objects. A big problem with Beobles is that they're non-local on the manifold. These diffeomorphisms just push your fields all over the place. So they don't live on the manifold in a local way. So it makes it difficult to picture what the real physics is. So the way to get out of that problem is to take on some ideas from this approach due to Hans Westman and Sebastianus and it's on ego. I couldn't find a picture of Sebastian, but that's a picture of Hans. Let me illustrate their idea with some example. So consider a situation where the fields that you have are the metric, the electromagnetic field, and a bunch of chemical currents. So A runs over the elements. This is just an example to motivate this picture. So there are something like 120 different elements. Then if you've got these objects, you can construct a bunch of scalars from these. So these are some examples of scalars you can construct from these objects. You could construct many more. You can denote these scalars as a list. So this theta is a list of scalars labeled theta A from A goes from 1 to K. So this could be quite, K could be quite big. Not very big, but quite big. And now what you can do is you can define these scalars which look like tensors. So you define them like this. So this is a scalar that looks like a current and so on. Okay. Now, in general, physics is messy. And so generically, you would expect to have different values of theta, of this theta vector, for each point in the manifold. So that's a sort of non-degenerate case. If that's the case, then you can invert these equations. You can invert these scalars to reobtain the tensors up to some general coordinate transformation. So in the case where everything is non-degenerate, then you can get the tensors back. You can imagine making a longer list. So this is bare theta. So I have all the scalars I had on the previous slide, plus all these additional scalars. So you could have a very long list of scalars. Now you could imagine drawing a graph that has, as the axes, the values of each of these scalars. So so this would have, you know, a large number of axes. I can only draw three. And you can plot the points in a solution into this space. So you take this very big graph. I've only drawn three axes. This, incidentally, is just a figure I stole off the internet. It's not related to any calculation I've done. So you take three axes. You would, in principle, you'd actually have many axes to this graph, some hundreds, maybe thousands, but still a finite, not too big number. And if you plot the solution into this graph, you calculate the values of the scalars, you'll get some surface, which generically will be a four-dimensional surface, but it might pinch down in places to less than four dimensions. This example is two dimensions, of course. It may pinch down in places to less than four dimensions, but it can't have dimension greater than four. And the reason for that is that the values of these scalars is controlled by points in the manifold. So as you vary over the points in the manifold, you're only ever going to get to four dimensional surface. I'm assuming, incidentally, that these fields are smooth. If you have the non-degenerate case, where this surface is four-dimensional, then really everything, all the physics is in there. But there's a problem if you have degeneracy. And to deal with that problem, it seems that you still need the equations of standard general relativity. Okay, so now I'm moving on to my approach to pager. So first of all, as I said, I introduce a Heisenberg cut. So we take the beerballs, and I'm going to partition them into things I call observables and all the rest, so schematically like this. So what are observables? Well, I'm going to make an assertion motivated by the work of Hans Westman and Sebastiano Sonego. The assertion is that we can only directly observe coincidences between scalars having specified values. So all our direct observations of the world have to be based on these things. Okay.
Was there Feynman in his book that mentioned this?
I think I don't know that he first came in. So Bergman has the idea of representing, you know, using scalars to set up a coordinate system, a physical coordinate system. Maybe Feynman has it. I haven't seen it.
No, it's just.
Okay.
You said you have a scalar field in the universe, and that's that gives you a prepared clock.
No, I didn't say that. No.
Okay.
No.
So, what do you mean by scalar?
So you have all the scalar fields that I mentioned. So you nominate a set of scalar fields. So I gave you the examples in the model of this model. Go back a bit here. So here are some scalar fields that you can calculate from the various tensor fields you have around. Okay, whatever scalar field you want. So I'm going to nominate a subset of these. So for example, you could nominate the, let me just go back. You could nominate these objects.
Okay.
It can be any subset of scalar fields you have that can be built out of the tensor fields you have in the physics that you're looking at.
Okay, so you don't have, but you have currents. It could be actually a scalar, right?
Yeah, it could actually be scalars as well. Yeah. But
it could be like a Higgs field or something.
Sure, it could be, but even if you've got tensors around, you can use those tensors to construct scalars. Yeah. And you'd want to nominate. I'll come back. You want to nominate scalar fields that kind of correspond to the sort of physics you think you observe. You know, so it's generally likely to involve matter.
Coincidence.
Right. So this so you've got, say you've got five scalars, phi one through to, S one through to S five, then S one has a certain value, phi. So say S one is equal to 4.2, S two is equal to 3.6, etc. So you specify, you take the scalars, you specify values. Those are the things you observe. So anything like that, each value has a, so basically it's points in the graph. That we draw.
You mean like S one as a function of S two? Is that what?
No, I mean so here's. Here's just three. These are three scalars. The things you can observe are points in this space,
okay,
according to this assertion.
But does it matter where you take these values?
Sorry?
Any point in a space?
Well, I mean, this point here is a particular set of values. Every point in this space is a particular set of values for these scalars.
No, I mean in real space.
Sorry?
I mean so these are values of this scalar at the same point in the space-time.
No, no. So that's right. Yes, so you'd think that there has been the same value at the same point in space-time. Yeah, maybe I should.
Okay.
Something I didn't mention on the work of. Okay, let's go back here. Yeah, so you calculate the scalars at a given point in space-time using the manifold, and that will give you a point on this graph. But then what's interesting is, so this graph, if this is a four-dimensional surface, then the points in this are parameterized by a manifold. However, you can perform diffeomorphisms on this manifold, so that moves the points around, but it leaves this surface unchanged. So this is kind of an essential insight of their work, that the manifold is just a way of parameterizing this surface, but the real physical object is the surface.
But it seems that like, the choice of a scalar is like choice of a coordinate system.
And it's a bit more than that, though, because it's also you may at a particular point make it's playing the role of giving you a coordinate system, but in addition to that, giving you also the things you would measure at any point in space. So all the things that you can measure are taken to be functions
these
of this.
Coordinates are observables, actually.
So that's
physical.
So the flat surface, in principle, could intersect itself.
Exactly. Yes. It could be very messy. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And so, in the nice case, if physics is very messy, then it won't intersect itself so much because every point will tend to be discriminate different from every other point. If you have a lot of symmetry in your physics, then it will maybe even go down to a smaller dimension. It won't be four dimensional, but lower. Yeah. So it could be quite messy. But the point here is to try and find something that is a good candidate for the kinds of things we observe. So I'll give you an example on the next page. This is the point. So we imagine all the things we observe are of this nature or based on this kind of thing. So this is the space that we live in, the space that we see, according to this assertion. So observables are built out of points in this space. The good thing about this is it restores a kind of locality. It doesn't restore locality of observables to the manifold. The situation there is hopeless because of diffeomorphism invariance. But it does restore, but you can think of your observables as being local in this space. That's obviously very important.
So what's the difference between an observable and an event? I mean, in general relativity, one can think of an event as a coincidence of all of the fields, you know, at a point.
Right. Well, then it would be an event. Yeah. But some. So then you could say these are the basic events, if you like, in your thing. Except that as long as the important thing about this is that it doesn't, you're not tagging these points with a position in a manifold. That's some unnecessary structure.
Whoopsie is a very different from an event, because if you consider like homogeneous cosmology, then this would be kind of yes all the time. But like the pre-image of this in the manifold would be a huge manifold.
That's true.
Subspace of this manifold.
Yeah, I mean it's true that if you have flat Minkowski empty space, flat Minkowski space, then you just have a single point. But when you think about it from the point of view of what we can see, that makes sense because you see the same thing everywhere.
So I mean the problem. Sorry.
And you can't distinguish where you are anyway. You've got nothing to hold on to distinguish. So
I guess the problem is that do you want these coordinates to be like some of them be time-like and some be a space?
No, I didn't say that. No. I've just defined they're just scalars that have values. I haven't put in any interpretation that they're time or space-like. And you won't need that property.
So the mapping from this to the manifold could be multi-valued, like very.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. But what this assertion buys you is a kind of locality. You change the space, and now you're local in that new space. So let's just think about a very simple example. So imagine you have fluid blobs. I talk about fluid blobs instead of test particles because really you have to work with fields and you can define fluids in terms of fields.
But you're not local really in this space because the mapping from manifold to this space is not bunched.
No, you're not local in the manifold space, but you are. But you can talk about observables as being local in this space. I can say locally in this space. I can talk about this, seeing this.
But like Einstein equations aren't local.
Absolutely, sure.
Okay, so but I mean,
sure.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But we have to, yeah. So we have to find a way to reconcile that according to that assertion, this is the space we live in, and yet the physics we have is fundamentally local in a different space on the manifold. Sure, this is an issue, which could be a selling point in the end. As if I ever get to slide 67 or something, Carl. was there another question?
So can I think of this as a generalization of Wheeler's superspace?
Of whose?
Superspace?
I don't.
The superspace are configurations, if you want, of all of space.
Yeah, I don't know that that's the case. I mean, not me to be the case, but that's, I mean, I want to, I think as long as it's clear. Okay.
Why that scalars hyperassortments cannot be more than four dimensions?
Why? Well, so each scalar is a function of x. X is a point in the manifold. And if you sort of move around a certain point, you can only go off in four directions. And all these functions are taken to be smooth. So the surface has to be parameterized by at most four-dimensional. Is it most four-dimensional? Okay. We'll maybe discuss it more later. Okay, so imagine you have, so the point of this slide is to illustrate that the difference between viewables and observables. So imagine you have four blobs, okay, made out of different types of fluid. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, and 4. Well, if you nominate the, let's say the densities of these fluids as your scalars in your space, I called this the OSC space, the observable scalar coincident space. So if you nominate those as your OSC space, then you'll witness this intersection and this intersection. You'll be able to see that in the space. But what you won't be able to see is the extremal distance between these two points. Even though that extremal distance is a viewable. So you can write down a diffeomorphism invariant quantity for the distance between this intersection point and this intersection point. But that's something that's real because it's invariant under diffeomorphisms, but it's not it can't be a point in this space. That might worry you, but it's actually not a bad thing, because here you haven't actually set up an experiment to measure that distance. So you're not able to directly observe it. The only way to observe that distance is to set up an experiment to observe it. And then you'd be able to read it off your space, off this space here. So here's an example of an experiment to observe the distance. So what I do is I introduce an additional two types of fluid, 5 and 6. And let me just go over here. And imagine that this fluid blob that's moving between those points is comprised of two types of fluid. And we imagine that initially we have the fluid blob consists of fluid type 5 in one hemisphere and fluid type 6 in the other hemisphere. But we can also imagine that these are miscible fluids, so that the two fluids will mix in some well-characterized way as the fluid moves from the first intersection point to the second intersection point. And consequently, from the degree of mixing, you'll be able to read off the time. So if we assume that that is following a geodesic, then we'll be able to read off the degree of mixing between these two in the OSC space, in the space over here. So this is a way to set up an experiment so that we can actually measure this distance. So in this case, the extremal distance was observable but not observable. Now it becomes observable because we're actually performing a measurement.
So what enables us to actually set up this experiment if these two, the initial blobs are actually not connected to anything else? They're off on their own. What I'm suggesting is that you can never have that isolated situation. Reality, everything's interacting with everything else.
I mean, this is a Gedanken experiment, so let's not worry about messiness. I'm just saying I should have continued this line down here, because that was a. We just have a whole bunch of blobs, and we notice this configuration. Later on, we can talk about how that happens to be with the notion of agency, but here we just keep it simple. This is just a Gedanken experiment to show that we have things which are beables but not observables. But we can observe them in this kind of experiment. Is that clear?
So why do we need this distinction?
Well, it's essential, because if you want to do operational quantum theory, operational general relativity, you need to know what are the things you observe, so that you know what things to talk about, what things to do problem, what things, the hidden variables are things that you marginalize over, the observables are things that you observe. So it seems essential to me if you're going to understand how to use this kind of theory in an operational way, you need to know what the things is.
So effectively,
Could you continue there?
So you are going only to put kind of quantum properties on the same scene?
This is all classical. I'm not talking about quantum.
No, eventually.
Eventually.
On the observers, not on the...
Yeah, but for the purposes of this talk, it's entirely classical. I mean, obviously, I'm motivated by quantum theory. This is a distinction which I think exists in general relativity. And if you imagine any experiment you perform in general relativity, my assertion is that you would always ultimately be looking at things like this. You'd be looking at the coincidences in the values of scalars. If you wanted to measure a distance like this, you'd have to do something like this.
But you said there are 4 scalars. There could be more than 4 scalars.
There could be hundreds, thousands.
Okay, then,
yeah. Yeah. You could nominate. You need to nominate a set of scalars which is rich enough to capture your experience.
Okay.
Because so this is operational.
Not
yeah.
Far enough.
Yeah. So. So probably. Well, you need a sufficient number to do that.
But it's not obvious that there would be no. Sorry. I guess go ahead.
But then you see, basically, you can convert like things which are. Not observables into observables by adding more scales.
That's right. Yeah. But they're still beables. This is still a beable. Remember, I repurposed the word observable. So usually in general relativity, when people talk about observables, they're actually talking about beables, things that are taken to be physically real. I'm introducing this distinction because it's essential.
Yeah.
Can you summarize the distinction? Beable is observable, but an observable is what?
So a beable is something which is taken to be real.
Yeah.
So you know, it's not under different morphisms or any gauge transformations, it takes the same value. It's not affected by different morphisms. Whereas an observable is something that we would actually observe. And to do that, I need to say what observables are. I need to make an assertion, but I think I'm making a good one.
And so what is the assertion?
The assertion is this: that these are the things we can measure. We can see. Yeah. It's a very similar distinction to talk about Bell's work. I'm not sure how many people know this stuff, but Bell talked about local beables and beables. And local beables are things that make up the world that we see. And then beables are just everything, including local beables. So it's sort of, you need to talk about...
So the beables are the scalars and the coincidences of the...
Yeah, so the beables are points in this space, which is spanned by the values of scalars.
Mm-hmm.
The observables are points in that space. But the beables can be any quantity which is a function of the solution which is invariant into different morphisms.
But I guess not every beable is capable of becoming an observable, right?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, probably you can always make anything which is a beable influence some future physics if you're able.
The distance between a point inside and outside an horizon.
That's true, yeah, that's a good point, yeah. So maybe that's an important
thing. Because such a kind of event.
Yeah, yeah.
But in a sense, all beables are functions of your observers.
No, because this is a counterexample. You can't, in this example here, there's no function of, so I've got here four scalar fields representing, I could have however many scalar fields I want to represent this physical situation. There's no function of those scalar fields that will tell you what the extremal distance is between these two points.
No, I can compute on a given solution. Given all these values, I can compute the distance.
Yeah, but you need to have the metric or something like this, which is a tensor. You don't have it available as a scalar.
No, but you do your physical matrix, so I can convert it into a scalar also.
So you have what, sorry?
This physical matrix, you define the metric in a physical coordinate system.
Which one? The one I defined earlier?
Yeah,
but that.
So what
would that be here? Here you've got you need some non-zero scalars knocking around to be able to do that.
You could have this curvature scalars,
right?
Gravitational waves, all kinds of stuff.
So here I'm imagining, because this is a Gedanken experiment, that the physics is flat.
Well, you're imagining the space.
Just for the sake of argument. So I mean, one could argue with this. Maybe it's difficult because these blobs would induce. But I think. From a Gedanken point of view, this is clear that there's no way to distinguish this point. So you can't calculate this extremal distance in terms of this space.
Is that not analogous to saying I've got two disjoint universes, and conjecturing got two separate universes which have their own structure, their own vehicles, and it's only when I join them into one universe. I recognize that the fact they're parts of one universe that I can now make use of the observables within that unified universe.
Like maybe, but I feel
calculate
like
calculate all of the beables.
I mean, here I'm just talking about very standard general relativity, but within a but talking about it from this point of view with this definition. So I think it's.
What he's saying is that if you only have access to those blobs, to those scalar fields, the metric could do anything it wants beneath. Because you don't have access to those different freedom in that setup.
These scalar fields are non-local.
Sorry?
These quantities you constructed are non-local.
Which quantities?
All of space-time.
Which quantities?
The quantities you're using to define your vehicles.
I mean, I'm using the scalars, which are
but they're scalars that are constructed from all of the various fields on space-time, but they are non-local quantities. They're not localized at points on space-time.
So you can set up an experiment. Let's think about this from an experimental point of view. I measure these scalars and I look to see what values they have in coincidence, and I jot down in my notebook what values I see for this. These are the points in my space, if you want to think of it like that.
In general relativity, we can't perform any measurement locally.
Well, I'm telling you how to do it locally in this space. In this space, everything is local. Your observations are local in this space.
But from a space-time perspective, those represent all of space-time.
I mean, it's true that you can move these points around on your manifold by different morphisms, however you want. But within a particular representation, they.
But like when I read off the time on my watch, that's a local experiment, and it's in general.
You have this space of all scalars.
Right. Well, it's a space of a nominated set of scalars.
Yeah. So general relativity basically gives you. I mean, all the predictions of the theory tell you what surfaces are possible in this space.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, let me move on because there's a lot.
Given a surface, I have a solution.
Right.
And then I just don't get it because it should be in principle possible to calculate all answers from this given solution.
You mean given the surface in this? You don't necessarily.
Given the surface.
Well, here's an example.
The only problem I might have is that the extremal distance between two points in this surface might not be well defined because it's a homogeneous solution or something like this.
Well, there may be many quantities which are viewables in the sense that they're not that they're invariant under different morphisms, but they're not captured by. If your surface is four-dimensional, then you're right. Yes.
Sorry?
If your surface is four-dimensional, that's true.
Yeah. No. That's what I mean. I mean, it can happen that some stuff is not well defined.
But there's no.
Is that the difference between viewables and observers?
But it's important, though. That might even be the physically generic case that the surface is four-dimensional in a sort of messy universe.
Yeah. No.
Universe.
I understand that a homogeneous solution would be kind of a line or whatever it is.
It would be like a point or a line or whatever.
Okay.
Like a spatially isotropic universe would be a line. But, okay.
And so the answer to like these extremal distances would be generically that the distance is zero.
No, but
something
but.
Like this.
Okay. Okay, so I hope I'm not sure to what extent I'm still clarifying and to what extent we're just trying. So what I want to do now is talk about turning a solution inside out. So this is just a way of thinking about the solution from the point of view of that surface in this space. So the idea is that if you have some long list of tensors. At a point, this is the tensors in your theory. You should be able to convert that into a pair, where one is the point in your space, in your OSC space. This is S, and then the other is everything else. Okay. Now, one way of doing that is just if this omega is equal to phi, but it may be this should be a more efficient way of doing it, I have some. Some ideas for have some ways of doing that. So now what I want to do is define the hidden variables in this way.
So omegas are the hidden variables?
Well, omegas, they're kind of the hidden variables. Actually, lambdas are going to be the hidden variables.
But where are omegas then?
Omegas, well, that's. Let me try to draw a picture on that one. So this is a big list of tensors. So take this at a certain point and represent it in some coordinate system. Then I have lots of different real numbers that give you all these tensors. So I can just, this is now a different space from the one I was plotting over here. These are the axes of all the real parameters inside these at a certain point. Now inside this space, the ones that have the same value of S will just have the same S. The same value in this space over there, they will form a surface. And if you take a different value of S, you'll get a different surface. Okay. And then what we want to do is parameterize, so to speak, perpendicular to these surfaces. so that we don't waste parameters. If we already specified S, then it'd be nice to know what's the additional parameters we need to say. So parameterize within these surfaces. So S is telling you which surface you're in, but it'd be nice to know where you are on this surface, and that will tell you what phi is. So omega is to parameterize internally on these surfaces.
So that is the hidden variable.
I'm going to use that to make the hidden variable. That is a hidden variable, yeah. You can't see it, so it is hidden, but I'm going to use it to construct this object lambda. So in quantum foundations, lambda is the sort of time-honored symbol that's used to represent hidden variables. And this is the object I'm going to construct. Take the value of this quantity, each point in the part of the manifold that has the same value of S. Okay, so this is the subset of the manifold that has the same value of S. In the case where we have this non-degenerate situation we talked about earlier, this will just be a single point. But it may, in general, consist of a continuum of points. So M sub S may be consist of a whole bunch of points. Is that clear? So those are my hidden variables.
Let's see if I've understood. Suppose I try to use your scheme to talk about where I am on the surface of the Earth.
Okay.
Say I take the local temperature, the force of gravity, mm-hmm. wind speed in a certain direction, and that's my scalar space.
That's your OSC space.
And I could potentially use that to figure out precisely where I am on the surface of the Earth. But maybe a more convenient choice, the scalars that I'll nominate, are the particular signals I get from the GPS satellites.
Right, yep.
And then temperature, force of gravity, and so on, become hidden variables relative to that choice?
Yeah, if you only nominate, I mean, you would want to nominate a set of scalars that are rich enough to capture your experience. But if you were a sort of temperature insensitive creature, for example, then the GPS signals might be sufficient.
I guess what I'm wondering is, are the hidden variables relative to a particular conventional choice of what you're nominating to be your...
That's right, yeah, absolutely, yes, yeah.
So if I choose conventionally to make it the GPS signals,
yeah.
Then for me, temperature and force of gravity and so on become hidden variables.
That's right, yeah. But if
I happen to prefer to use temperature and force of gravity and whatever other scalar field,
yeah.
Then for me, the GPS signal becomes a hidden variable.
That's right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But neither of those choices are very good because our experience is richer but sure, you could do that. That's right, yeah. But of course, even if you nominate all possible scalars, you will still have hidden variables. That was what the example with the blobs was meant to point out. So there's no number of scalars you can nominate that will save you from having hidden variables in some situation.
So distances between points on the Earth would be, in my example, a hidden variable?
Let's not talk about the Earth, because the Earth is so messy that you can always find enough stuff around to determine anything. But out in space, of sort of you're in empty space with just blobs, then yeah.
So isn't the only situation on which this can arise like situations with symmetries and solutions with symmetries?
Well, I mean, the situation I showed you wasn't especially symmetric. It just didn't have a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, but I didn't really understand the blobs, so
okay.
I disagree. This is conclusion.
I thought the blobs would make things simpler.
You don't have to think about blobs.
An example would be cosmology, where, in fact, you would claim basically the coordinates. Uh-huh. And the spatial coordinates would be your hidden variables. That's what you define there. Because all scalars would be on the same.
Say again, spatial coordinates would be?
Homogeneous cosmology. Everything is homogeneous. All the scalars you can imagine are homogeneous.
That's right, yeah. Okay.
So
except maybe possibly that you could define funny scalars which give you actually the distance of the scalar. And if you fix one thing, then it's.
There's supposed to be physical, local scalars.
Yeah, things that we measure, like the density of the density of hydrogen, for example, maybe something.
So if you just take cosmology, then basically the coordinates, because you have P. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a bit unclear what you mean with this P actually in this.
P's are points in the manifold.
Basically all points in your manifold. I mean, the coordinates of these points would be hidden variables.
Cosmology.
On your spatial,
well, I'm defining hidden variables in this way. I mean, the points in the manifold are hardly even hidden variables. They're just parameters.
No, that's why I'm asking what P is.
P is a point in a manifold. So
in the space-time manifold? Or
yeah, in the standard space-time. Well, yeah, in the standard space-time
manifold. I think Bianca's point is about cosmology in particular, where nothing it depends on the space. Everything just depends on time. So your scalar is just depends
right.
on time. So you can know time, but there's no way of knowing the space from.
Okay, yeah. So in that case...
a space coordinate is a hidden variable.
In that case... Well, then you would construct it by this process, and you'd see what your hidden variable was. But I mean, it's hard to take an example like that,
but they're basically not observables.
Yeah. So you have very few scalars around. So, yeah. Okay. So.
I think there's a, at least I'm still confused, it seems to be a basic point. Let's take the cosmological case, FRW, homogeneous, spatially homogeneous. Will your hidden variables suffice to restore the whole space-time? It seems to me they won't, because your point of view is that the vehicles just don't give us the whole space-time.
Yeah, so...
So that whatever the hidden variables give us, it won't be the full four-dimensional. Is that correct or not?
I'm not sure quite what you mean. I mean, these hidden variables, I still haven't washed out. They still depend on your coordinate system or your representation. So you can perform diffeomorphisms on these.
So the hidden variables
also
can involve coordinates.
So you start off with a list of tensor fields, okay?
Right.
Which are not. I mean, then you convert them into a list of scalars and some other parameters. And it's those other parameters that you use.
From the other parameters, you can construct the whole tensor field then?
You can go back. The idea is you can go back. Yeah.
Well, so the information on the four dimensionality of the space time is in there.
Yes, everything
even
should be in there,
the case where we're just doing an FRW cosmology.
Yeah, I think it's all there. So the point is, let me just finish that with the slide. So the point is that you just take, so this is a solution like the one you're talking about. So any solution you can write like this. And you can take a solution like this and convert it into one like this and back. So these two things are equivalent. So that's the idea. So you can take a solution as you represent it as a set of points in your space, in this observable scalar space, observable scalar coincidence space, and at each point, I'll just draw, here's a graph. So here's this surface, similar to the one that we talked about before. And then at each point in this space, you have a hidden variable constructed in the way I described.
So some of the hidden variables are not viable in this particular case.
Well, I mean, they're not represented in a diffeomorphism invariant way.
No, I mean, they're not viable at all, because there's nothing in what's viable that tells you you're in a four-dimensional space. But the hidden variables suffice to give you that information.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's true. That there's something in the hidden variables which I mean, you need a particular representation, a particular coordinate system to represent them. So not all of that will survive if you just construct the physical part. But the intention is to eventually wash that out as well. Okay. Well, I'm effectively out of time. So let me think of a strategy here I think what I'll do is I'll show you a few highlighted slides just to give you a flavor for what happens here. So the notion of agency is actually very common in physics. So you have things like knob settings, which are used in operational quantum theory. Or in Newtonian physics, you have external forces. You might even think of initial conditions as being like that. So they really correspond to something that you choose to condition on, where you're not interested in discussing the physics of how they got to be that way. So you could think of, in our context, you could think of them as corresponding to an effective level of description where there are certain processes that are below the resolution. Certain processes where effects that are below the resolution that you're working to get magnified to being above the resolution that you're working to. So, you know, there's a neuron firing the brain, and you do this thing or that thing, and you get this sort of magnification. You can put that into a general relativistic context. So here's here's an example. Imagine you have, well, if you have a spaceship, and the captain makes a choice to go this way or that way, well, his choice will have an influence on the quantities that you're interested in, even if you're working to a resolution which is above the size of his brain. And you can try to include, or you can include that kind of effect by introducing forces or force densities. And in particular, you can imagine that the force density that acts on these spaceships is given by some function that's parameterized by some field here. So that's the rough idea. So I've done all this. You can imagine a whole vast fleet of spaceships, which would comprise a kind of dust if you look at it from a sufficiently sufficiently large scale. And then these could actually be spaceships with sails that interact with a wind. So then the interaction would be given by this, for example. And so you'd have some field that parameterizes that interaction. Of course, if you gave a description of the physics that went below the resolution of the brain, then you wouldn't work to this. You wouldn't work with this anymore. Okay. I'm gonna. So the idea in this approach is to build up a description of the physics that goes on in this space. This is the OSC space again, the same space that's here. To build it up from looking at what's happening inside small volumes in that space. I'm just rushing past this. And you can use the notions that I talked about before to construct propositions. Once you know what your propositions are, then you're in a very good situation to construct probability theory. So there are two kinds of propositions, ontic propositions, and on the next slide there'll be operational propositions. So operational propositions concern only where you are in this space. There are things that you can observe, whereas the ontic propositions concern the extra stuff that's there in the solution, the hidden variables. Then the idea is to try and do something similar to what was done over here. In fact, this kind of general setting is very appropriate if you've identified what your knob settings are, so what your agency choices are, and you've identified what your outcomes are, so what your operational propositions are. Those are the things that correspond to observables. Then you can take this kind of picture and convert it or apply it to general relativity. So to do that, you take propositions and you apply some extra structure to them, which enables you to, I'll just go to the next, enables you to join these propositions. So you can take two smaller parts of this space, this observable scalar coincidence space, and you can join them together to make map particle objects that correspond to bigger parts. And there's various rules for what you do when you join. This is as far as I got in writing the paper. And then what you can do is you can associate with these propositions generalized states. So these are basically lists of probability. So now you're applying the mathematical machinery of generalized probability theory. and you can talk about how to join these things. So then you start to have, then you have the mathematical machinery in place to calculate the sorts of things you might be interested in. So you might be interested in what's the relative probability of one proposition versus another proposition being true for some given region of this space. And these objects I talked about, well, to do that calculation, you first of all have to see if the objects are parallel, are proportional. So this is a sort of test to see if you can actually make this prediction. But then if the two objects are proportional, then the constant of proportionality gives you the thing you wanted. So this is a whole bunch of mathematical machinery that you can apply in this compositional way once you know what your observables are. Okay. So once you have this, you can start to think about how to go to the quantum case. And I had three ideas about how to do that. One is to replace the sort of simplexes that appear in this framework, because it's classical probability theory, by Hilbert space derived objects. The other idea is that when you start to look at Pager and you take it away from the sort of situations where the sort of generic situations where you have this kind of messiness, then it starts to have a lot of quantum features. So it's possible, unlikely, but possible, that you could actually get quantum theory out of this. It's extremely unlikely, but it's just conceivable. So one immediate objection to this would be that quantum theory violates Bell's theorem, violates Bell's inequalities, whereas general relativity looks like a local theory. But don't forget that the space we live in is not the same as the manifold space where the equations of GR are local. So it's just possible that that GR is would actually lead to non-local effects in this space and could violate Bell's inequalities. It's just possible.
It's guaranteed, actually.
I'm not so sure about that. My intuition actually is that it won't if you really set things up properly. But
well, I think that this is the main thing is that we were mentioning that you don't have a natural, a spatial coordinate candidate, mm-hmm. at least in a cosmological setting, for example, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. everything evolves with time, mm-hmm. but there's nothing that's monotonic with the space. There's no physical observable that's monotonic.
Oh, okay, but then you just can't set up Bell's.
But even if you perturb that, then things are non-monotonic. Like density increases and decreases. Mm-hmm. So there could be lots of places in the universe that have the same S1 and S2 and S3, I guess.
That's certainly true, yeah, that you can get the same. So that's kind of the way I'm thinking that this may lead to something like this. But I think you have to be careful before making a claim like that. So, it's possible. Okay. The last idea is to try and modify the sort of basic theoretical structure that went into this, so not to work in this space, but something which is similar. That I won't talk about. That was the half approach. I didn't really get past the initial starting point for this project, but what we have here is a sort of an approach to putting probability and agency and operationalism into general relativity, just classical GR. The project is similar in some ways to operational quantum theory, and it's possible that you could put some axioms on this abstract structure that would be similar to the kinds of abstract axioms you get in operational quantum theory. So I'm thinking, for example, that you have completely positive trace non-increasing maps in quantum theory, which is deeply related to properties of causality. And it might be that you could apply similar notions in this abstract framework. So have a kind of abstract general relativity. I'll skip that point. Yeah. So hopefully, if one can get this thing nailed down, then it's a potential starting point for a theory of quantum gravity. And I'm sorry I had to rush through all the main points, but I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Maybe just a couple of questions.
I have a question about causality. Do you have an operational definition of causality? If you don't assume that there's a space-time, there's a configuration.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. So one of the good things about this approach is that when you introduce agency, then you have more conceptual machinery to actually define what you mean by causality, and it's more similar to our the intuitive notion of causality we have is, you know, we always say, well, if you do something here, then it shouldn't the effect shouldn't propagate faster than the speed of light. Well, now we can actually say what it means to do something because we've built agency in. So using those kinds of notions, I've written down a kind of consistency condition for causality to hold, but I'm not satisfied that it's fully operational. I can show it to you. What I'm looking for is a causality condition which is similar to the causality condition that's used in these operational quantum theory frameworks. Something I call it the Pavia causality condition, because a bunch of guys from Pavia came up with it. And that condition actually constrains the operators in a very substantial way, so it's quite an important condition. So yes, I'm working on that, but I haven't got that pinned down properly yet.
Maybe I have a question about this agency, because in some sense, at some level, it looks like you're introducing a problem. I mean, this agent is, as you're describing, outside of the realm of physics. You know, it's kind of a classical non-back reacting object that you can change. So,
I mean, let me ask the question. I don't think so, because I think what I'm trying to do is something very conservative. How would you treat the situation where you have, you know, a person or a computer, whatever, that's going to steer a spaceship this way or this way, and whether they do this or this depends on a bit, that's zero or one. Well, that bit can be stored well below the resolution at which you do your simulation for general relativity, and so it'd be nice to have a way to introduce that information. Without having to, without having to increase your resolution to include that, and all I'm suggesting is a way to do that, so that you can have these fields that.
But the agents are somehow outside of the region.
Well, they're only it's because you're taking an effective level of. Whenever you do effective physics, you're always putting something outside.
Your description.
Yeah, but they're not outside the physics in any sort of, you know, in any strange way. They're just a normal way that you some part of the world, you're just going to condition on some facts about the world rather than try to predict them from your physics. So it's just a question of what level of resolution you apply.
The worry is, suppose, let's say you want to know what replaces space-time. I mean, how much of the choice of what you're going to call an agent, might already contain or constrain the answer you're trying to get. What I'm worried about is that this agent, I'm not sure what it is, but it sounds very macroscopical and classical, so not quantum and not gravitational. So
I'd argue that they are quantum, that quantum theory has a notion of agency built into it. One way to see that is that is the quantum state contains information about, tells you how to calculate probabilities for different incompatible choices of an agent. So why would it even bother to have that information if it wasn't concerned with the choices of agencies?
Okay. Maybe I didn't get you can share your definition of agent. Maybe this notion of
not. Yeah.
Another
way to think about it is
I'm worried that by defining my knobs are something.
Yeah, so I think you can do that.
You're putting some kind of preconception about.
Another way of thinking about agency is that, when people do simulations in general relativity, typically they take some initial conditions and evolve them forward in time. And here you can think that rather than conditioning just on initial conditions, you're conditioning on stuff also in the middle of your simulation.
That's a good example. Depending on the theory, say classically your initial condition would be, you know, a manifold, but then quantum mechanically it would be something else, and then quantum gravitationally. So whatever you're going to condition depends. I mean, usually Mm-hmm. It's once you know your theory that you say, oh, that's a good agent, right? It's hard to design an agent which would be good for any
area. Now it sounds like you're discussing sort of, you know, Wegener's friend or something, or these various questions in quantum foundations. And it's true that there are sort of interpretational issues there. But still, when you apply quantum theory, you make a choice. You say, well, these are my measurement apparatuses. And so on.
Once you have quantum theory, you can decide.
Well, but you can actually get quantum theory by putting it in the framework of agents. You can say, well, I'm going to think about a general abstract framework where you have agents and making choices, and then I can get some mathematical structure, and quantum theory is an example in that general framework.
There was a question by Raphael.
Does the agents change?
Go ahead.
Does the agents change under renormalization?
Yeah, I think that might be the case. Yeah, that because it's really an effective level of description that you don't want to, you specify these fields to represent the choices that agents are making. But if you go to a lower level, then you would treat those agents physically, and so you wouldn't specify them like that. Yes, I think that's the case.
Well, I had many questions, one of which Laura already asked about causality, but there's something I'm not getting about the whole picture. So you say that it's a probabilistic framework.
Yeah.
So in standard quantum mechanics, at least as far as we understand it so far, probability comes from the Born rule.
Right.
So where is probability getting into this?
So this is classical. So you just have to, you know, you go back to the product slide.
But are we introducing some a priori probability?
So certainly, what you have, if you have a proposition that pertains to this space, then that doesn't tell you everything. There's the hidden variables that you don't know, and so one way to deal with those is to put probabilities on those hidden variables. Now, what actually tells what determines the particular probabilities is a matter for discussion. You know, maybe you use some kind of, you know, reasoning from statistical physics or a model of your measurement apparatus or so on. But the point is to make a framework which is hospitable to probabilities in the first place, even if I can't tell you how to calculate those probabilities. So
does it amount in practice to putting some a priori probability distribution on the initial conditions of the universe? Or?
The problem with that is that you have all these different choices of agents in the middle, and so it has to. I don't think it does. No, it's.
So there's another source for probabilities as well.
Yeah, it amounts to saying. I'm trying to think of a good example. So in classical probability theory, you have these stochastic matrices. You know, you have something goes into a box and it comes out, and that stochastic matrix tells you what the probabilities are for, you know, a given output, given a given input. So that mathematical object, the stochastic matrix, is local to that box. Doesn't care about the initial conditions of the universe. And these objects are like that; they're local in this space.
Does it mean there's something stochastic about what the agent is doing? This is just classical.
This is just classical, it amounts to assuming some probability distribution over these things I call hidden variables. Within each region of space.
So, I guess a related question is, what are the knobs that you're talking about?
What are the what, sorry?
You said the boxes with knobs.
Oh, right, yeah.
So
yeah.
I didn't understand. I mean,
I rushed past that very quickly.
What corresponds to the knob?
So what corresponds to the knob is a choice of, I call it a choice of strategy, of agent strategy. So the agent will see a particular value of S and decide to do a particular thing according to that value. So choose some fields that go into the partial differential equations in a way that depends on the value of S. I mean, I'd have to show you the detail to give you a better answer.
Does it mean that we'll end up with some stochastic Einstein equations to describe the geometry?
No, because the equations themselves remain deterministic. But we have to put probability distributions, you know, just like in a de Broglie-Bohm model, you have to put probability distributions in, but all the equations are deterministic.
Well, there you have, but there they are, all the probabilities are initial probabilities. But you're saying that these probabilities are coming.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, in that sense, they're coming from something else. I mean, I have to admit, although I know how to write these mathematical objects down, it's slightly obscure to me as to what the right physical interpretation is at this stage.
And is there a limit of this in which it's purely deterministic?
So
you get back standard.
As long as you have, if this surface that we talked about is four dimensional, then your hidden variables are.
But these agents are making random choices.
No, that they would make. When you do an experiment, you don't make random choices. You have a strategy. You say, well, I'm going to do the experiment in this way. That's usually decided beforehand.
Okay.
So they're chosen in some particular way according to a strategy.
So the knob is just the choice of agents, basically.
The knob is...
If you include in the agent what they're going
to... Yeah, so the knob is...
What they're predetermined to do anyway.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So can I think of an agent and the description in terms of the space with the S? Can I think of that as being a coarse-grained representation of the space-time, and all of the hidden variables represent the microstructure that's being traced over, if you want. Mm-hmm. And so I can think of that, all of those degrees of freedom that are associated with hidden variables as the entropy of the universe, that hidden information that I don't have access to unless I do some particular experiment to go in and probe. So what you're really talking about is taking a coarse-grained representation of our space-time or geometry.
Yeah.
And I could do the same thing in cosmology. Very coarse-grained view, but that doesn't mean that there isn't all kinds of detail going on.
Except it's much, it's more, it's not trivial because you need to know what your observables are. You need to, you have this problem that there are hidden variables, things you can't access.
But the observables I'm looking at from a coarse-grained perspective.
Right. So coarse-graining is certainly going to be part of the picture.
So I'm wondering whether there's actually more to it than coarse-graining. In other words, the hidden variables, hidden quantities that could potentially become observable, design an experiment?
So in classical probability theory, you can think of it in exactly these terms as coarse-graining. But there you have a well-defined causal structure, a well-defined background time that you can evolve your system on. You know what your observables are. It's all simple.
Yeah.
So the theory of stochastic matrices and so on is easy to implement. Here you don't have that. And so to say it's just coarse-graining misses the point, because you have to define what your observables are in the first place. You have to find a way to deal with the fact that you don't have a foliation into space like hypersurfaces, because everything is stochastic. So it's more problematic than that. So it's not just coarse-graining. You have to find the right theoretical structure into which to put those notions. So that's the issue.
If I understood correctly, I should think of Pager as a framework for theories of causal structure. That's kind of like a landscape in which I could consider different particular theories.
Mm-hmm.
So am I right in thinking that general relativity is one point, say Newtonian gravity would be another point? I could express those theories within this framework.
So it's slightly more specific than that, but you're kind of right that certainly any theory you make this assertion, you say these are your observables. Now, Newtonian gravity, you can probably say, you can probably give yourself the luxury of having a fixed background space-time that you imagine is observable and so on, so you don't have a problem there. So
I wonder if I took a solution to the Einstein field equations that, just for simplicity, had enough scalar fields that there was no degeneracy problem, And then I wanted to know, how could you re-describe that relative to this framework? Like, what would be the, so I imagine, say, some local observers who are implementing agency, observing things. Could you sort of re-describe what evidence would count as evidence in favor of GR in that framework?
So if you have a solution, so that's a solution across space and time, so on the manifold. So that sounds like you've already got a fixed choice of your agents everywhere. So you in this framework, you would just specify some fixed strategy, your agents that would specify the fields, I mean, there's a difference in philosophy. Is the problem that the philosophy here is to try and calculate probabilities of correlations that you can observe, just like we do in operational quantum theory. Whereas the usual philosophy in general relativity is to calculate a solution and go, wow, this is what's going on in the world. And I'm trying to take that approach. So, yeah, I'm trying to recast general relativity in accord with the first philosophy. So I can tell you how to calculate probabilities. And that's all I want to get.
Let me rephrase my question. I guess the analog of my question in the quantum context is when you yourself wrote down, here's how quantum theory looks in the R and P vector formalism, that was basically saying, take this familiar thing, and now here's what it looks like in this unfamiliar
language. Okay.
And I guess I'm wondering, to what extent do you know how the familiar thing, general relativity, with no real probabilities, just everything's deterministic.
Right.
And ask, if I recast that in this unfamiliar language of pager, here's what it looks like.
So I think in the case where you have solutions that correspond in this space to a four-dimensional surface, then all your variables can be observables. And then you can cast it as a sort of deterministic solution in this framework, and all your probabilities will be equal to 0 or 1. That would work. In the case where it's not four-dimensional everywhere, then you'd have a problem.
Maybe a question is, maybe that's a really good question, that in this space of observables, one surface is GR, and then you could choose another surface, which would be modified GR. So how would you formulate the search for the Einstein equation?
Right. So at this stage, I just want to, the idea is just to kind of hack it, to get general relativity into this framework, and then I went past a lot of things very quickly. Yeah, so when you form your sort of generalized states, you only allow non-zero probability for the things that correspond to solutions of the partial differential equations.
Mm-hmm.
In general relativity, anything which corresponds to a solution in this space will be allowed, and then you have probabilities over those allowed solutions.
What I'm asking is, let's say in the old formulation, essentially, if you say you can derive GR just if you say essentially locality and default environments, then you get GR.
Right.
So there's a principle.
Principle
for the search.
Yes, I'd love to do that here, but that's.
GR is one surface, but it's it has some space.
So I'm hoping it would be great if you could do that, and I have some optimism. Mm-hmm. Possible. So this is what I was talking about here. So you have this general framework, and at this stage, the only way I know how to get the allowed generalized states is to sort of hack them in from general relativity, just the ones that happen to be solutions to all this big set of partial differential equations. It would be fantastic if you could just impose some very general axioms on these objects that give you the right states. And there's some reason to be optimistic. So in the case of quantum theory, one of the great things about this operational framework is that you only have to impose a small number of axioms on the operators associated with these boxes to get quantum theory. Now, to realize any particular box, you might want to engineer it knowing the Hamiltonian and so on and so forth. But the actual constraints in the abstract sense, that are there are very, very few. And it's possible that you could do the same thing here. And furthermore, it seems like these constraints have to do with causal structure, which is exactly the thing that Einstein's field equations are about as well. So there's some reason to be optimistic, but I'm a long way from being able to do that. Yes. Yeah.
So one of the problems I see here is that in general relativity, if you have a vacuum, then you have no observers, you have no agents to act, you have no ability to do measurements. Mm-hmm. So the real strength in general relativity comes from defining the relationship between the geometry and the matter. And the constraints that you're looking for, the differential equations, are really constraints on the matter more than they are on the geometry, because the geometry goes along for the ride. It's saying the stress energy tensor needs to be conserved, and therefore that maps quite nicely onto the Einstein tensor, and so that then defines the geometry. But the matter is what's really critical about this. And the matter is it's ordinary standard model matter, it's quantum matter, and it does all kinds of things. We don't have any particular set of constraints on the matter that are going to say this is the space that you can define in terms of the configurations of the matter. Anything to bring.
Right. I mean, but whenever you simulate, you have partial differential equations for the matter as well.
Well, in that case, I'm assuming certainly, a very particular model, but I'm removing agents from that because the matter isn't just doing its own thing. There's no agents involved in that. I could certainly put them in. I could, we can send out rocket ships to blow up asteroids and that sort of thing. We can do macroscopic things to the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want to build those into my models, I can.
Mm-hmm.
But normally when I build a model, I don't bother putting agents into it because I'm trying to just find out what happens in this generic situation. And I'm not at the level of dealing with this thing, trying to integrate with quantum mechanics. I'm working at a fairly classical level, which involves a lot of uncertainty.
So the motivation for this project is to try and formulate general relativity in a way which is similar to the operational formulation of quantum theory. The reason I want to do that is because I think the operational formulation of quantum theory is the one we understand best. It's the one that...
But are you looking at vacuum general relativity? Or are you looking at the integrated...
We
have matter sources, in which case general relativity isn't quite so... It's nearly so well defined that I can say, here's a set of differential equations.
Why is it not well? I don't understand the problem.
Well, if you've got the Einstein equations, they don't.
You have
stand
a definite choice. Is a definite choice of the matter fields.
Yeah.
It's all classical. A definite choice of the matter fields. There's a Lagrangian for the matter fields, and the metric.
Yeah.
That's his theory.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're putting all of the matter fields in,
you need enough. Yeah. I mean, I just want a complete set of partial differential equations, and then I'm okay.
But your differential equations for the matter fields are going to be far more numerous than the differential equations for the geometry. That's really
right. That's fine. I'm just dealing with an abstract framework. So, I mean, those things don't really worry me. As long as I can abstract in the way I'm talking about, I think it's fine. And I think what I've talked about is not specific to any particular model.
Do you want to tell people to go?
Maybe let's take